Good morning. Thank you to my fellow panelists and chairs for lots of good examples, memorable quotes. Happy as I am that things are better in Nova Scotia, Rob, I'm going to have to give up a whole storyline that I often work into speeches about P3s, because the Nova Scotia story has been instructive, as you mentioned, for other provinces. I guess sometimes things have to get worse before they get better. RAV, for example, comes to mind as an example. And that brings me to sort of where I want to focus in this presentation. Never accuse QPBC or the organizing committee in shooting too low. I was given 15 minutes to talk about the impact of independent school funding and the impact of private money, particularly in infrastructure and post-secondary education, in 15 minutes. I demonstrated last night that it takes me way longer than 15 minutes to talk about something that's considerably smaller. So I'm not going to try to do much more than just hit a few points that have occurred to me around strategy on these issues. We benefit on both those topics of having some really fabulous research done, particularly around issues of post-secondary level. I guess all those faculty members, understandably, are interested in pursuing the environment around them and the impact of private money on them. Let me start first with independent schools and independent school funding and think about strategies there. I got into a conversation last night at the Wine and Cheese about, you know, given all the issues in front of us right now, is that one to go at? You know, how high should that be on our priorities list? Yeah, 10.5% of BC kids K to 12 are now in private or independent schools, and yeah, it's now $186 million a year, heading for $200 million in the next couple of years. It's being pulled out of the budget, but how significant is it anyway? And I can't answer that question for you. I talked about sort of the public policy issues of private schools last night. But I think there's some opportunities we can take advantage of in that whole discussion. I thought QPBC's intervention and to link public alarm and concern around Bountiful with the issue of the publicly funded private school in Bountiful was inspired. You know, that's seizing an opportunity at using, as we would say as teachers, the teachable moment to get across to the public some of these issues. In Alberta, I think it's about 2 years ago, the Klein government was very interested and was being lobbied to extend more funding to private schools, and put together a traveling commission after a little bit of opposition from his own backbenches and from the official opposition. And I think that turned out to be enormously beneficial, because when the Alberta public actually sat down and paid attention to the issue of what independent schools were already costing in Alberta, there was no appetite to increase funding at all. And a very clever intervention by the Alberta School Boards Association, and you might think of this as an option if you take on this issue. There's something like 147 private schools in Alberta. Randomly, they picked every 10th one alphabetically and looked really, really carefully at its terms of incorporation, at who was on the board of directors, and what the purposes were of that institution. Now, in the text, it complains about these being significantly unaccountable. I mean, my version of what you do with public money is account back to the public for how it's spent, right? Not to mention the public purpose that's supposed to be served by those dollars. And when a board of directors of a school receiving public funding is limited to members in good standing of a particular church hierarchy, it's not really hard to convince the public that there's something wrong with this picture. When you look at the objects and intentions, the mission statement of the school, and it's Corinthians 2:14, and that's it, people start to wonder, is this an appropriate use of public dollars? So in that case, the scrutiny, if you can get something like a public inquiry going, a traveling roadshow, whatever, turned out to be extremely beneficial. To save face, the Alberta government upped spending a little bit on private schools, but their enrollment has not shown the boost that British Columbia's enrollment has. You're growing faster than anybody else in the country. In general, there is not an exodus to private education. BC is somewhat the contrary to that general trend, a little bit complicated by the fact that within your independent and private school sector are also Catholic schools, which are fully funded in some other parts of the country, as I talked about last night. I would strategically emphasize the generosity of BC. You know, a lot of ordinary people reasonably assume that things in education are pretty well the same from one province to the next, and it just isn't true, and we need to do a lot to educate them about the differences. Need to deal with the argument that says, well, you know, even if the government is paying 50% of the bill to educate K-12 kids in private schools, that's still cheaper than 100% of the bill, which would have to be picked up by the taxpayer anyway, right? It's a very common argument. Okay, if the average per pupil spending is, for example, $6,000, then the private school gets $3,000 to educate that kid. And they'll say, if we send them back to the public system, it's going to cost you six. No, it isn't. And it's really important we break that down. Because, well, first of all, each kid doesn't cost the same amount to teach in time, in resources, in energy, attention, and all of those things. And I talked last night about how schools are able to choose the child rather than the child choosing the school. And that means that the cheapest and easiest to teach kids typically are being skimmed off. So while the per pupil amount, you know, when you say per pupil expenditure is $6,000, or it does not mean every child receives exactly $6,000, right? That's just a numerator and a denominator, and that's it, when we come up with that money. And if you take 10% of the kids away, you know, your heating bill for the school hasn't been reduced by 10%. The cost of transportation, you know, the bus takes the same route, the same hallways are cleaned. By and large, the same teachers are hired. Now, you could end up, theoretically, with 10% fewer schools and administrators and teachers and all of that. But they would have to be absolutely typical kids, and they would all have to come from exactly the same area, right? You have to take an entire community and pick them up and send them to a private school in order to reduce your costs equivalent to an equivalent degree. So I think we should debunk that argument, because it's awfully easy for the other side to use and say, hey, why worry about it? It's saving us money. No, it's not. Now, I don't know what the exact numbers would come out as, but it would be a really interesting piece of research to pursue. Let me see. I want to turn just briefly to post-secondary and the impact of private dollars. Many of the points were already made that there are multiple impacts of privatization. And one that, looking at the age range of people in the audience, I suspect is near and dear to some people's hearts, and that's the spiraling cost of tuition. Again, your public needs to know that it isn't the same in every province in the country, that there are alternatives, that Manitoba, for example, has frozen over a long period of time. Quebec has done the same. They need to know that the fact that, you know, I talked about the OECD report last night and where how low we are in K-12 spending. We're actually second from the top in post-secondary spending. But that's because Canada continues to graduate more young people from colleges and universities than any other country in the world. That's an enormous accomplishment. So if you're the group that you are educating is much larger than average, yeah, your GDP is going to look as if it's a high percentage. But if you break that down to what you spend per student, in fact, Canada's not doing very well. So we have to get a handle on those two different numbers. The kind of privatization that worries me a great deal is parents quietly writing checks, taking out second mortgages, working longer than they intended to. You know, I understand why CFS and other student groups have focused on student debt as a real issue related to tuition. I don't disagree. But there's a quiet kind of parent debt that isn't being talked about, and we haven't really worked on building those alliances or getting those parents to come out of the woodwork, like a friend of mine working in Manitoba. For years, this was the year she was going to retire. I said, so when's the party? When I talked to her on the phone, and she said, I've decided I can do it for 3 more years, and then my last one will be through university. You know, the middle-class parents made these commitments to their kids that they want to keep. And we aren't getting at that. I mean, I think the real stories there and alliances, it isn't all on kids' backs. Still on tuition fees, serious problem ahead. Bob Ray. Bob Ray is chairing a commission in Ontario to look into the whole problem of university funding, including tuition fees, and is doing a roadshow. Place after place, students are standing up and talking about the fact that they won't, at this rate, they won't be out of debt until the year 2042. I mean, the debt load is unimaginable. Student after student after student is presenting the facts and the figures and the analysis. And from what I hear, Bob Ray is sitting there and saying, you know, I just don't think debt is the issue. And it has apparently really been quite shocking. And it is very clear to people close to that process that what will come out of that is a recommendation for income contingent loan repayment, increasing the amount kids can borrow, increasing the length of time they have to pay it back, and possibly increasing the level of family income at which you can actually be eligible for a student loan. That's one of the problems as well. So talk about foolish ways to solve large problems. Increasing debt, taking longer to pay, basing the rate of pay, how quickly you must pay it back based on your income, has all kinds of other implications about who continues to university. And increasingly, we're seeing a skewing towards the richest kids now rather than the poorest cohort. That's a real break with Canadian tradition, and we've tracked it. It's been tracked by StatsCan for a long time. That continues, but it also skews the kind of programs that you're going into. Like my friend Carol, if I had not stayed working long enough to promise my kids they would be debt-free for their first degree, I don't think either one of them would have taken philosophy programs, both of which they absolutely love. You know, paying that kind of debt, you start saying, well, I guess high tech is the thing, eh? I guess it's the wired world. And there were never two individuals less well suited to taking technology courses than my kids, but I'm sure there are a lot of others out there like that. We have to tease out in our strategy the cascading consequences, all the way down to the personal one that says, I love philosophy, but I guess it would be really dumb to take that. All the way to the decisions about, you know, how much money and how much influence Apotex buys. So the threads, the connections are complicated. It's particularly useful that so many sectors are represented in this room, because it seems to me if any strategy is going to work, it's an integrated one. Thank you.